Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an amazing guest that is going to be joining us. We're going to be talking about a bunch of stuff. You know, we're going to be talking about financings, you know, getting a ton of rejections, you know, really coming out on top, you know, on several financings that our guest has done, you know, building a rocket ship that he's in, but really remarkable journey, you know, coming to the US, obviously as an immigrant, you know, incredible story. I mean, I'm also an immigrant, so I love those stories. But again, all the good stuff like building, scaling, financing that we like to hear. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Yemuel Joseph. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So originally born and raised in Ethiopia, how was life growing up? Give us a walk through memory lane.
Yeah, it was really different than I think the childhood experience that one would have here. You know, spent a lot of time outside, sort of just being creative and in nature. And, you know, there was a moment in time where I started realizing that technology was taking off. That was sort of at the 2000s. And what I would say is it felt like technology was coming to Ethiopia slower. I remember, you know, being as a kid wondering why dial-up was so slow and internet bandwidth wasn't really what I thought it should be. But at the same time, it gave me enough exposure to be curious about what was going on in the rest of the world, especially through things like TV and reading books and such like that. And so it was sort of a mixed balance of both, you know, having just that great childhood experience, not having to be too exposed to technology, but at the same time, having an awareness of what was going on.
So your parents ended up deciding to come here to the US and, you know, you came here to the US, you did your high school, college, all of the studies, but coming here to the US, I mean, I'm sure that for you was quite a shift, no? I mean, new friends, new life. How was that? How do you think that shaped you?
Yeah, you know, fortunately for me, there wasn't a language barrier coming to the US. I had spoken English and had gone to a British school in Ethiopia. And so that part was much easier. But what was striking was I was exposed to a much broader sort of set of things, particularly the internet. As I mentioned earlier, you know, the internet speeds weren't particularly great in Ethiopia. And so when I moved here, that was the most fascinating thing for me, to have all of this knowledge and all of this opportunity sort of at my fingertips. And, you know, in high school, I think I was struck by just the differences in kind of the high school experience. Definitely kind of what I saw in movies was sort of real here. But really the thing that struck me the most as being different was just how much access I had to knowledge and information and the internet.
So then for this too, I mean, how was it like to like see your parents, you know, going after like the American dream, you know, obviously coming here to a new country too, like seeing them working hard for a better future for you guys? I'm sure that was also very inspiring for you.
Yeah, it was, you know, my parents worked for the UN in Ethiopia, which was the African headquarters. And so they relocated to work at the New York headquarters. And it was very inspiring because they sort of took a leap of faith, thought that there would be a better education and a better path for me to continue growing, you know, my life ultimately. And I think they were absolutely right in that. But, you know, at the time, it wasn't so certain. They didn't know, you know, how great the public education system would be, how I would assimilate, whether I would transition and start a new life here. And so there were a couple unknowns, but fortunately, I think it worked out well.
So then in your case, you ended up going into architecture. So how did that creativeness in you sparked up? You know, why architecture out of all things?
Yeah, I think for me, it actually was a pretty last minute decision towards the end of high school. You know, from a very young age, I've been interested in technology and was building websites even when I was in Ethiopia. And so when I started to think about what I wanted to do professionally, at the time, software engineering, sort of in the 06, 07, wasn't really as present, or I wasn't as exposed to it. And so I picked a career that would, in some sense, give me maximum optionality, something that involved design, something that had technical aspects to it, but most importantly, you know, was a professional industry with sort of a clear path. And so that's how I ended up in architecture. But to my surprise, there was a lot of interesting work happening and overlap between my core interests, which were, you know, building things in computers virtually, and what was happening in sort of my professional career path, architecture.
So you met your co-founder during this time, you know, so it was pivotal going into studying architecture. So how was that, you know, that journey for you guys to meet up, to start to discuss and to brainstorm about a future where you could bring something of your own, you know, to a problem that you were encountering, you know, which ended up becoming Cover, but how did it get there to really see Cover in a tangible way? Like, hey, you know, it's time to launch this thing.
Yeah. The way, you know, we sort of got to Cover is actually very natural. You know, as we went through school, I started to realize that the pace of architecture wasn't even close to the pace of technology. And what I mean by that is, you know, as a 20-year-old thinking about what I wanted to do in the next 10 years, I noticed that there were engineers pushing code to millions of people and raising all of this capital to make their vision a reality. And what I saw in architecture was a stark contrast, where I saw people graduating and spending, you know, the next 2 decades working through the corporate ladder and not really having the agency and autonomy. And so I had the sense that that wasn't really what I wanted to do, and was paying a lot of attention to what was going on in venture, particularly at the time Y Combinator and these companies like Stripe and Airbnb and Dropbox taking off. He at the time was sort of exploring a similar thing, but in a different dimension. He was wondering why there wasn't high quality housing still abundant. He actually had went and worked for, you know, these really high-end architecture firms, realized that the material costs weren't necessarily the limiting factor in these projects. And he noticed that there was a lot of coordination, that is, like all of these consultants working to build these one-off, you know, very, very expensive homes, and had this, you know, question, which was, well, if you just, you know, had a product you designed and built over and over again, you could eliminate a lot of those coordination costs and probably make housing much cheaper. And in fact, he went and worked for a prefab company over the summer. And so we were really sharing our observations, me really about the pace of progress and technology, and him around sort of these core issues that he was identifying that were limiting architecture and construction to progress. In those conversations, we came to a conclusion that there were probably 3 things that hadn't been tried before together, that if they were tried together, would have the best chance at, you know, offering high quality housing at scale. And so those 3 things became the basis of Cover. And we realized that nobody was doing it and nobody would do it unless we gave it a shot. And that's how we started the business.
So then for the people that are listening to Get It, what ended up being the business model of Cover? How do you guys make money?
Yeah. So ultimately we built homes for people. And so instead of going to a general contractor that builds homes conventionally, you'd come to us and receive effectively the equivalent thing, which is a home. But we do it very differently, in that underlying how we get you a home, there are 3 basic ideas. The first is that we want to build homes like cars. And what that means is we want to redesign and re-engineer the product for mass production at scale. And so in the future, our factories will look very much like car factories, where, you know, there's, you know, potentially automation, an assembly line, and what comes out are these panels and components that can be rapidly assembled into various layouts, which is the second idea, which is that we actually let homeowners customize the layouts. And so even though you're getting your home built in a factory, there's still the ability to configure the layouts and the finishes and the options that come in your home, which historically hasn't been the case. You know, if you think about Sears Home or other prefab companies in the past, what they would do is they would offer you a catalog of options and you'd have to pick one of 16 layouts. And so we actually changed that. The final thing is we are vertically integrated and we streamline the entire process. And so, you know, in a typical kind of architecture firm, what you'd have is you'd have people, you know, managing every element of the process, such as drawing, you know, the plans and permitting them and then managing, you know, the construction drawings. And there's all of this documentation and sort of operational processes that drive up the cost of building a home. And to solve that, we build software internally. And so, you know, for example, today, for any project we have, even though it's a custom layout project, we're able to automatically generate permit sets instantaneously, do the structural calculations instantaneously. And we believe that that not only, you know, lowers the costs to our customers, because they don't have to pay for that overhead, but it also just improves their experience because of how much shorter the timelines get. So yeah, you know, built homes like cars, custom homes by using panels that can be reconfigured, and then software to streamline sort of the back end processes that traditionally you'd need to hire many, many people for.
So then I know that in this case, you guys had the YC Fellowship, you know, Y Combinator Fellowship. How is this different from, let's say, like doing the accelerator program?
Yeah. So, you know, when we were leaving college, we applied to YC Core, which is a program most people are aware of, and they interviewed us for that. But we weren't quite a fit because, well, we hadn't built a home or proven anything. And at the time, they're running the smaller program, which was meant to resemble what they originally ran when they were, you know, running the program out of Massachusetts, which is that they'd give entrepreneurs $20,000 instead of, I think at the time, $120,000 for 7%. And they'd let you build over the summer. They would have you meet with partners. And then they would give you access, of course, to the network and a demo day. And so, you know, we didn't get into Core, but we did get $20,000 to move to the West Coast. It was four of us at the time. And we used that money to live in a house and build our first kind of cover concept in the parking lot.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So for these guys, I mean, you actually went through the ringer when it comes to raising money, you know, as a whole. Obviously, that was the starting point, you know, with the YC Fellowship, you know, to get outside money. But it has been a journey. I mean, all in all, how much capital have you guys raised to date for Cover?
We've raised about $70 million.
So it has been quite the trip to raise that. And obviously you did your seed and then you did the Series A and so forth, but it hasn't been easy. So walk us through, how has that journey been of raising money?
Yeah, so we had actually tried to raise money when we were still in New York City in college. And what we noticed pretty quickly is that the venture community at the time on the East Coast wasn't really investing in hardware or hard tech. Rather, they're investing in software or consumer or things like that. And so, you know, we had a sense that, well, if we're going to raise capital, it's going to be the area. And sure enough, it was. We raised the $20,000. But even then, there weren't a lot of venture capital firms, you know, investing in housing startups or hardware. It was perceived as, you know, really risky because of how capital intensive these businesses were. And so what ended up happening for us just over time is that we, you know, had to convince a small set of investors that really got the opportunity and the potential of solving this important problem. But we had to prove things at a much smaller kind of scale. And so, you know, with the $20,000, we built our first prototype. And so people could actually touch the product and understand what it would look like and feel like. And from there, we were able to raise our seed round from a couple of really amazing investors, Nico Bonazzos at General Catalyst, and Vinod Khosla actually himself at Khosla Ventures. And these were people that understood, right, the ultimate potential of and importance of solving this problem. But we didn't, you know, raise $10 million. And so we had to take that 1.6 and actually sell to our first customers and show that we could deliver it and show that this thing could be installed and that the quality was great. And, you know, and from there, it kept on going. And so it's been a sequential sort of pattern of finding investors that believe in not necessarily the short-term kind of outlook, right? Because this is hardware, it takes longer to scale, but believed in the importance of solving this problem and would give us capital to get to the next stage of proving the technology and finding customers.
And I know that there was quite a story there on the Series B as well, you know, that involved weekends and stuff like that. So what happened?
Yeah, that's right. And so, you know, even though we had proven things, right, we had raised the Series A from Founders Fund and Lennar, who's the second largest, at the time was the second largest home builder, there was still a lot of hesitation about investing in our Series B. And so, you know, we had been pitching just constantly. My co-founder was traveling to the Bay Area and back. And, you know, to our surprise, on one of those weekends, that we hadn't expected, an investor said, you know, that they were in LA on Sunday. And so they texted us Sunday morning saying, you can, you know, can you meet? And, you know, coincidentally, that was a weekend both myself and my co-founder were taking to spend time, you know, with our partners. And so, you know, there's a decision point around, well, you know, do we kind of prioritize our existing plans or do we just, you know, run over to meet these investors? And both him and I met those investors at our showroom in LA. And we spent 5 hours talking about the business with these investors. And the week after, we had a lead term sheet.
That's unbelievable. Now, obviously, you know, with investors, vision is a really big one. Yeah. So if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world, Jemuel, where the vision of Cover is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Yeah. So the ultimate vision of Cover is that we want to build communities and even cities. And our belief is at the core of that, we need a faster way to build and a simpler way to build. And so in the future, anybody, you know, in the US and in the world should be able to come online and design a home or understand what's buildable on their property. And if they don't have a property, be able to find a property and receive a few things which you still can't today, which is a fixed price, a timeline, knowing when you'll actually be able to move in, and certainty around the quality of what you're going to get. And once, you know, you like the home and you're committed to building with us, we take care of everything, all the way from, you know, the manufacturing, the permitting, the installation. And, you know, in 4 to 8 months, anybody should be moving into their home and just simply bringing their furniture in. And so that's really the ultimate vision. And the one thing I also want to point out is, you know, we make panels that come together in currently single family and ADUs, small backyard homes. But that doesn't mean that these panels can't be assembled also into different types of homes some of which we know of, like multifamily, but also potentially types of living that haven't even been invented before. And so that's something we're really excited about diving into once we solve the manufacturing problem, is, you know, what kinds of living experiences can we begin to offer at a larger scale, at a community scale, at a city scale? And that's something that we'll be able to tackle then.
So obviously, you know, like, you have amazing investors too that you've been able to rally. So how do you go about, you know, like, dynamics, you know, with investors? You know, obviously you have like really big logos, really big people there, you know, that are part of the team now, no? And especially part of the board. So how do you go about really, you know, making sure that there's good dynamics at a board level, and also making sure that you're able to use and leverage as much as possible the network and the value that they're bringing to the table?
Yeah. You know, for us, we've been really fortunate to have investors that have seen this kind of problem be solved. A lot of our investors were early investors in Tesla and SpaceX and have followed the journey from the very first institutional round to even now. Some of our investors are actually currently on the board, or were recently on the board, of Tesla and SpaceX. And what that means is that they get the challenges at the core, and there's that fundamental alignment about, you know, what we need to solve and how much time it takes and the sort of support we'll need from them along that journey. And that's made a really a great working relationship, is what I'd say. And we wouldn't have been able to get that if we weren't able to be selective and able to reach ultimately these group of investors. And so, yeah, the dynamic's great.
So in your case, I mean, you know, imagine now that let's say, because we're talking about the future, no? But I want to talk about the, you know, earlier, I want to talk about past, but talk about past also with a lens of reflection. You know, if I was to put you, you know, into a time machine and I put you back in time, you know, maybe to that moment that you guys were thinking about perhaps bringing something of your own, because I mean, you guys have been for almost a decade, you know, pushing Cover, which is like in corporate years, I mean, it's like 100 years, right? So obviously, if you could go back in time, you know, maybe to 2014, where you guys are about to launch Cover, you know, right before you were even thinking about it. And let's say you were able to have a sit down with your younger self and then also with your co-founder, and you were able to give your younger selves one piece of advice before launching a business, what would that be, and why, given what you know now, Jamwal?
Yeah. I think the feedback we'd give ourselves is to always go and solve the real problem. Oftentimes, it appears that there are, you know, maybe a dozen problems in front of you. But what we found is that for us, progress has been sort of most noticeable when we understand what is actually like constraining us. What don't we understand about the problem, whether it is about, you know, building faster, whether it is about making customers happier or finding customers. And it's really easy. And in our past, there have been moments where we've sort of not focused in our entire company on just solving the A problems, I guess, as we call them internally. And so, you know, there are these A problems and B problems. B problems being the simpler, sort of more superficial, maybe more comforting problems to solve. And then there are the A problems, which are, you know, how do we, you know, wrangle our supply chain, because that's affecting, you know, our timelines, and we want to build more, and we need to go solve that. We need to go talk to our vendors. We need to go rebuild aspects of the supply chain. And so I think as you have more capital, it's at the same time easier to solve A problems because you have resources, but at the same time, it can take you away from the A problems because now you can spend more across a variety of areas. And so I think that's been a big kind of learning process for us.
So then in this case too, I mean, when you go about problem solving, right, let's say like you have like, let's say like massive obstacle in front of you, something like completely unexpected, crazy event. I mean, what is that thought process or that journey of really solving it? How do you go about it?
Yeah. The immediate thing is to not attempt to solve it like right away. You need to take a step back and get into the room with the right people and actually understand what's going on. A lot of these larger problems, as you'd say, are actually, you know, not caused by a single thing, right? It's often something that causes it, but you need to actually go root cause what's causing in multiple layers in. And interestingly, 99% of them have been fairly simple things to resolve, meaning it's a few things that cause larger sort of observable issues. And we've gotten really good at just being able to root cause and to take a step back and get into the room with the right people to understand what's happening.
So I guess for the people that are listening, Gemuel, we'd love to reach out and say hi, you know, that are really inspired by the conversation. What is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, shoot us an email. I actually read all of the inbound emails at hello@buildcover.com. And also feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.
Amazing. Well, Gemuel, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.